Okay, today is December 5th, 2020.
Yeah.
Okay, nice. Is
this the 20th is on a Wednesday. So,
yeah,
so this is
our 21st. Okay. All right, let's go. Imagine such a question like this. I'm lining up Rashi. I'm lining up Rashbam. I'm lining up Ibn Ezra. I'm lining up Ramban. I may just give you certain statements, certain topics. There's not going to be a question, what does Rashbam say on this? That's a question for fourth grade. The question is, what would Rashbam say on this? Even if he doesn't. Okay? Got it? If you had Rashbam in the room with you, and you say, if you're his friend, you'll say, Shmuley, what is this, what do you think about this? Okay?
As long as you enter in, similar time.
It should be intelligent.
Okay?
Okay, if you can't answer that question right now, I'll give you some examples right now. We did the last class.
Yeah.
Then you got to listen to the classes. It's online, thanks to Mr. D. And it's, you have to spare it. I'm not going to show you anything we haven't, discussed. Okay? For instance, Moshe was married to an Isha Kushit. Right? What's Rashi going to say she was?
What?
Think this over a little, okay? How does Rashi approach a text of Moshe marrying an Isha Kushit? Yes. What's the first question he's going to ask? What do Chazal say this means? It's not a simple pasuk, right? This can mean a lot of different things. And he's going to say, what does it say in the Gemara about Isha Kushit? Anybody know the answer to that question?
Ethiopian woman.
Really? You can't look at the board and say which is the only one of these that would even think of going there? Okay, sorry. Alright, we spent half a class on this one question. Less than a week ago. Alright, finished. Next. Of these four, which stays most true to his constantly stated mission throughout his commentary? If you have to guess, we're okay. Yes? Rashbam is the correct answer to this question. Ibn Ezra does things in his Perush, which is so critical of Rashi. He says things that are so critical, and yet he himself does those kind of things all over the place. Right? He says Rashi is sometimes too esoteric, he delves off into Drash too often. Really, Ibn Ezra? What are you doing in Parshas Kisiso, where you talk about so much space about astrology and astronomy and what it means to see the back of God? All right, he's a philosophical commentary, but then write a philosophy book about that. Don't put it in your Perush. That's not pshat, right? I agree that what Rashi says, that Moshe saw the back of God, he saw the tefillin on the back of God's head. Ibn Ezra says that's it. Really, and what you say is better, right? You want purity in someone's Perush, where it always has to fit exactly in line? Right? Rashi is a multifaceted commentary. Remember we wrote five reasons why he may resort to Drash? I can break those down to 50 reasons why he might resort to Drash. Right? And Ibn Ezra complains that Rashi says that when Avraham took 318 men with him to save Lot, that it just means he took Eliezer. Right? Remember that? He didn't take 318 men. He just took... He and Eliezer conquered four kingdoms, four armies that are plowing through the whole ancient Near East. And just Avram and Eliezer took care of them. Right? Ibn Ezra mocks that. He says, what are you talking about? Because of Gematria? Lo Dibra Torah be Gematria, he says. There's no such thing as Gematria. He himself mentions Gematria a number of times in his parish. When he thinks it's compelling. So what's wrong with Rashi doing it when he wants to? Incidentally, Give me an intelligent reason why Rashi says that the unbelievable perush that two men conquered four kingdoms. Not just four kings, four armies. Why would Rashi say such a thing? Who are you writing for? How old is your audience? I don't think Rashi himself thought that it was just him and Eliezer. How do I know? Because later on, when Abraham is saying, he won't take any gifts from the king of Sodom, he says, I just want food and provisions for the men who came to fight with me. Right? You get that? Rashi there writes, talks about more than just him and Eliezer. It's the Pshuto Shel Mikra there in that Pasuk. Right? You follow what I'm saying? He has some hungry men that went to fight with him. So it can't just be him and Eliezer. According to Rashi, the Pasuk should have said, just give me food for me and Eliezer. Or just Eliezer, because I don't want to take anything from you. So, tell me, one of you, save me. What compels Rashi to say that those 318 men is just nothing but Eliezer? Yes?
Probably from a Medrash. Okay,
it's a Medrash or a Gemara. That could be enough of a reason. Right? Something like that. I think it's not sophisticated enough because Rashi does not just parrot what's written in the Gemara about any pasuk. He looks in the Gemara and he sees, how does this fit the words right in front of me? So what's compelling Rashi to say that when the Torah says he took 318 men, it's actually Eliezer? No, what's the first thing? I just said Gematria. Okay, what an amazing coincidence. Can you name me any other man by name that might have gone with Abraham in chapter 14 of Bereishis? You can't, because we don't know any other person. That's the only person by name that Abraham could take with him that we know. You hear it? What an amazing coincidence. Right? But that wasn't enough for us. What else did we say? Abram took 318 men. Doesn't your ear hear something unusual there?
Yeah, we usually round them off.
Right. The Torah everywhere else rounds off numbers like that. There's no other number like that in the whole Torah. Right? I can give you proofs of that. There are 100 proofs. Think every tribe ended with 000 in the desert? Okay, so that's Rashi. So Ibn Ezra says, he's writing for little children who are still nursing to keep the Torah interesting for them. Little kids like Gematria, right? Well, and so he brings Gematria himself sometimes. You got it? He mocks Rashi for saying, how did the Israelites get acacia wood in the desert to build the Mishkan? It says they built the Mishkan with Atzei Shittim. Anybody know the answer to this question? It's in the Chuvah. Where did they get Atzei Shittim in the desert? What? Okay, that's a possible answer, but that's not the answer Rashi gives. Where did they get Atzei Shittim in the desert? You never even heard the question?
Carried it from Egypt.
Yaakov planted it on the way down to Egypt, knowing that when they come back, there's going to be a Mishkan to be built in the desert. So there was all kinds of acacia wood growing over hundreds of years. And acacia wood gets very strong as it gets old. All right, beautiful. There's no hint at such a thing in the text, of course. So Ibn Ezra calls it into question. He ridicules it, right? What does he say? I have traveled through deserts. I have seen acacia wood in deserts all over the Middle East. Yaakov planted all of those, right? What does Ibn Ezra do to the question, where did they get acacia wood to build the Mishkan? The answer is, it's not a question, it's the hair. Acacia wood grows naturally in deserts. I'll say Shittim. Okay. Right? Rashi says that Yocheved was 130 when Moshe was born. Right? Ibn Ezra calls that into serious question. Right? Yeah, I hear his objection. And I can mention many, many more like this, where Ibn Ezra questions traditions that Rashi quotes from the Gemara. Right? But he's not pure himself in this, because when he comes up to a tradition where he has to rely on Chazal, right? I'm not objecting to him on these grounds. Ibn Ezra, and I keep tallies on this, right? I have a scholarly edition of Ibn Ezra, and I keep, I have really hundreds of little notes, keeping in mind every time Ibn Ezra insults somebody, every time he mentions Rav Sadigo, and every time he mentions Kibiya Balchi, every time, and he mentions Anu Tzluyim Bekadmonenu Chazal Beinyan Zeh Kihei, they knew the truth 100 times. So what makes you accept these traditions here and you reject the traditions there? The great scholars of Ibn Ezra can't come up to an answer to that. It's just that's what he felt what he felt. Right? This is a tradition I like. This is a tradition I don't like. So don't object to Rashi. Right? This guy, Rashbam, maybe you don't know enough about Ramban yet, because Ramban is such a multifaceted commentary that it's hard to pin him down to say, hey, Ramban, why are you doing this here? He's allowed to do anything. He's Kabbalistic, he is Midrashic, he is Pshat, he's everything. He's these three all together. Right? He's Rashi and Ibn Ezra all together, which is understood because that's what usually he does. Remember I read his introduction in last class? He says, I'm going to always put before me the menorah, HaTahora, that's Rashi, he's the Bechor, and I always have to quote Rashi, and I will show hidden love and open rebuke for Ibn Ezra by quoting him, and usually disagreeing. Alright? Okay? So the answer to that question would be yes, Rashbam. Okay? Has this level of purity where, I'll tell you, in a few places, Rashbam also veers off of Pshat, and I'll tell you, in scholarly circles, they usually say, when Rashbam does that, read between the lines. He's trying to do something which was very dangerous at that time. If you did it openly, think if you can figure out what I'm talking about, if you did it openly, it would get you killed. What might get you killed in the Parish to the Torah?
Disproving Christianity.
Right? Jews were, the Ashkenazic Jews in 1100, 1150, 1200, were exposed profoundly, force-fed, in order to force conversions. They were force-fed Christian doctrines. There was no shortage of former Jews who would go into shoals on Shabbos morning and give the sermon that morning over why you should all convert to Christianity. Right? And you couldn't go to Kiddush Club during that sermon. They had to say, pack the house. I want a packed house for this. Right? Giving a guest lecture today. Right? And it just didn't happen rarely. It happened all the time. So when your shul was just exposed to all the proofs that Tehillim chapter 22 is about the crucifixion and Tehillim chapter 89 is about the choice of God's Son to redeem mankind and to die for their sins. So when Jews are exposed to this, you couldn't give a counter shear the next week, which Christians might have thought was blasphemous to Christianity. You had to somehow, maybe behind closed doors or something, and then tell people why what you heard last week is wrong. So sometimes you got to write it in your parish, right? Okay. Sometimes Rashi even himself writes, with this I have responded to the heretics. And he got away with it, because the heresy inherent in the pasuk that he's talking about could be understood as idolatrous heretics who believe in more than one God. Those in the know he was talking about Christianity who believed in the Trinity. Right? Okay. Whether or not Christianity is considered idolatrous or not was debated in the Middle Ages. Right? Ashkenazic Jews came down on the side that it's not. It's just a type of heresy within Judaism. They believe in the Creator. They believe in the Motzi Mitzrayim. It's Mitzrayim. And some of them are closer to doctrinal belief than some people in the Reform and Reconstructionist movements. They don't believe in Tzias Mitzrayim. They don't believe in Matan Torah. You know what I'm saying? Christians believe that God revealed the Torah to a Jewish people publicly, and then just changed direction sometime. Right? Okay, so here, listen to this parish. Moshe is taking Luchos down from Har Sinai. Right? He has already been informed that the people down at the bottom are doing something awful. Right? Okay? He knows what they're doing, but when he laid eyes on them, right? Mistama is something, you know, Moshe sometimes acted on impulse, and he does something that is defined by these words. It says he grabbed the Luchos, Vayashlichem miyodav. Remember, if you recall, this pasuk came up when we did Yeshem Lamasora. The way, remember, it was spelled miyodav like that, without the yud. Remember that? Yeah, probably not. Okay, so Moshe did Vayashlichem. He took them the Luchos. And Vayashlichem miyodav. Can someone here just show me with your hands the motion that you think that takes? Vayashlichem miyodav. We have pictures of it, I guess. Huh? Yeah. I mean, it's pretty clear. Vayashlich. That's what Rashbam says. But what?
Throw it.
What?
Throw it.
If you had two tablets in your hand, okay?
Yeah, it would smash it.
Okay, I know. Here are two tablets, tablets, okay? And if you wanted to throw them, assuming they're heavy, but, you know, not so heavy that you can't, what would be a good place for your hands to be to throw them down in front of them? One can figure this out. Come on.
At the top.
What?
At the top.
Here they are, these two tablets. Okay?
Throw them, Marla.
Go ahead. You want to just... Yep. Wouldn't you like pull them up like this and do something like that? No? Vayashlichem means he.
Not if they're heavy.
Right? Maybe not if they're heavy, but alright, if they're too heavy, maybe you can't pick them up like that. But you probably try to get some momentum, no? Why would you say he just did. Really? Your Hebrew ear hears that it's just he had them here and he just. Push them?
He sent them.
No, that's for the ches. Come on. Lashlich with chok means he. Okay? Alright, anyway, Rashbam says that. Rashbam says he broke them by accident. He didn't mean to break them, Rashbam says. Right? Now, what's interesting is that Rashi says he did it out of anger. I don't find it in Rishonim this. The Meshech Chochma. No, we'll talk about Achronim maybe towards the end of this class and certainly by next class. But the Meshech Chochma says that Moshe, cold calculation, broke them in front of them. Simple, no, not angry. I just want to let you guys know something. You are attributing to this thing you just made with your hands inherent holiness that it represents the God who just took you out of Egypt? It wasn't the Avodah Zarah. It was lending to something physical that you can look at and make with your hands that's made of metal that you say represents the God that just took us out of Egypt.
Isn't that Avodah Zarah?
What?
Isn't that Avodah Zarah?
Even that is Avodah Zarah. If I'm going to say the object of the Egel worship was God who just took them out of Egypt. By the way, can anyone quote the statement Eila Elohecha
Yisrael
Asher Halucha Meretz Mitzrayim. Why would they have to say that? Why would they have to say, here Israel is the God who just took you out of Egypt? So it's pretty obvious. Who made this Egel?
The nation.
No. Israel did not make this Egel. Who did? They've got Aaron to help but to set it up. But who made this Egel?
The Egyptians.
Egyptians. It says when they left, began Erev Rav Olo Itom. Parshas Bishalach. It says, no, that's in Bo. An Erev Rav, you've heard of that, right? A lot of Egyptians chose their lot with these newly freed Israelites, and they went out with them. They said, of course you live in the absence of Moshe. It's a big compliment to Moshe. Moshe was your conduit to God. How can you go straight to God? You can't do that. By the way, this is Christianity, right? can't go straight to God. So Christians, we're not worshiping God because we're not going through their conduit.
Huh?
They took till 1967 for the Pope to say, yeah, Jews can also pray to God. Right? Even if not through Jesus. Which is, by the way, a change in Christian official doctrine. Right? It was an amazing statement. Right? Many Christians were very angry with that. Okay? Anyway, so the Erev Rav said, Eila Elohecha Yisrael, Yisrael, here is the God that just took you out of Egypt. And Moshe was very, very so angry with him? No. No, he wasn't angry. He just wanted to teach them. I'm going to break something in front of their eyes that to them should be even holier than this angel. Bless you. Why, right? Why should these things be even holier than this angel? Because God made it. Look at this. Got it? God made this thing. And I'm going to break it in front of your eyes to show you that nothing has inherent holiness. You got it? B'nai Eli made the same mistake. They took the Aron with them to battle, thinking, oh, we're going to beat the Plishtim, we have the Aron. No! The Aron, in the face of your behavior, is a box of golden wood. B'nai Yisrael in Yirmiyahu's time thought the same mistake about the Beis HaMikdash. How can God destroy his own Beis HaMikdash? We know God's power. He'll defeat the Babylonians like he defeated the Egyptians. No, this Beis HaMikdash doesn't have power to save you. It's just a bus. It's just a building. It's a den of iniquity, actually, in the face of your behavior. Right? So that's what Moshe was teaching them. And according to this opinion, Moshe broke them not in anger. He just broke them to show them what you're doing wrong. Okay? Micha, I'm going to take you in a second. Rashbam just says that he accidentally broke them. You get it? One, Rashi, in anger. This perish in cold calculation to teach them something. Third perish now is Rashbam that says that he broke them by accident. He didn't mean to break them. Now, the critics of Rashbam say, Rashbam, what are you talking about? Vayeshlichem does not imply breaking by accident. Well, give me a Hebrew word. Anybody here speak Hebrew?
Nishbar.
No, because Vayeshbar also implies he meant to. What would be a... Say it in English then.
He dropped them.
But he called me a dog. Wouldn't you expect to find that if Rashbam is correct? Right? I thought you're pure, Rashbam. How can you give such an outlandish page? If what you're saying is correct, you're a Hebrew speaker, what should it have said? Not by Eshvichem Yadav, but by Yiplum Yadav. They fell from his hands. Got it? So this is what scholars of Rashbam claim, is that when you see a parish like this, I'll just give you this example because I want to move on, but there are many others like it. He's saying something against Christian theology. Now, that's not such a simple thing to prove. What Christian theology does drop in the luchos respond to? You don't know that, of course. I don't expect you to know that. But if you were sitting in shul on Parshas Kisisa, right, and a Catholic priest who was a former Jew tries to convince you that there is a broken covenant with Israel, and he reads some psukim in Yirmiyahu and other places to prove it, right? And then he says, and Moshe himself knew this by breaking the luchos as a harbinger for a future broken covenant, right? Because the Christian knows, how am I going to convince these Jews around this area that they don't have to keep Sabbath anymore? Now it's Sunday. You can eat leaven on Passover. You don't have to circumcise your children. Because the Christian reveres the Tanakh. The Christian Tanakh is part of their Bible. Right? It's just been overcome. How can you prove to the Jew that the Bible has been overcome? The answer is, Moshe already gave us the impetus to one day break the covenant. It was just waiting for the right man to do it. By breaking the luchos. So what's Rashbam's answer to that? He did it by accident. You're telling me historically that Christianity is an accident? That's brilliant. He gets to write his perush, right? And he doesn't get killed for it. Because those who are in the know will understand what he's doing. Did his contemporaries understand this? There are many such Rashbams which seem to defy his derech of pshat. Right? It's not the pshat to say by Ashkenazim. It's just about your emotion. He says that he pushed them away like this so that they wouldn't fall on his feet. Right? It didn't even smash in front of them. It fell by his feet. Goodness. What a departure from what we always thought happened there. Certainly from the movie. Remember the movie? Right? The Ten Commandments. All right. So that's the correct answer that James gave, which is that of these four, Rashbam is truest to his cause, if you will. And I might think that Ramban is also, but Ramban is just so hard to pin down to one derech. He hints a few times in his Perush that my Rebbeim told me never to reveal the secrets I have to reveal in my commentary. I leave them very vague, right? A few times in his Perush he refers to the greatest secret of mankind that very few people can fathom, right? This great secret that can resolve all your philosophical problems, right? By the way, it's this week's Parsha where he writes that. It's Parsha's Vayeshev. He writes it the first time about this great secret. He says, I have had my philosophical problems with the way the world is, but until I fully understood this secret, I didn't have my philosophical answers, but now I do. But it never tells you what the secret is.
What pasuk did he write it on?
He writes it on the story of Yehuda and Tamar. And he writes it a few other times in his parish, but we've had Ramban to study 800 years. The commentaries to Ramban have basically figured it out. All right, it is a concept which the Rambam never mentions, Sadigo never mentions, the Talmud never outright mentions. Right, some medieval commentaries mention it often. The Zohar mentions this on every other page. Anybody figure out what I'm talking about? Gilgul, reincarnation. That you are not the first, your soul that's in you is not the first time that it was in a human body. It could be the 15th or 20th one. Right? Okay. And Ramban says there are those who are able to look at a person. He says the Ari apparently was had this capability. He was even able to tell what animal was in the previous lives of this person. Because there was transmigration of souls from humans to animals, according to one school of reincarnation. You can, what part of a body you can look at to determine what the previous life is like. Really? Okay, so I'm just saying, when you have a commentary that's really dedicated to pshat, because Ramban is. That allows things like that to get in. By the way, what would that have to do with Yehuda and Tamar? What's in Yehuda and Tamar that he would mention this here? Because, you see, Yibum is taking someone, a dead brother's wife, and naming a child after him. You know, what's going on? Yeah, the child, ooh, gets the soul of his uncle. Wow. Okay, that's your question. I'm just giving you a little glimpse of why it's very difficult to nail this guy down to one particular derech that he's staying true to. All right, okay. But that's why I'm my proof of what I'm saying. Rashbam, yes, he is throughout his perush. You know, Yishakushit is going to be Yishakushit. Lavado la'olam is going to be for the rest of his life. And when he veers off of pshat, your derech is going to be, because he's speaking to a select audience about possibly about anti-Christian Christological perish. Michal,
what you were saying that Moshe broke the tablets intentionally to show that they weren't holy, or that they weren't intrinsically holy?
No, they weren't intrinsically broke. That's that middle perish.
Yeah.
In other words, one that he broke it in anger. One that he broke it with cold calculation,
tent, and one, and he broke it by accident, just contrasting with the Perusha. Yeah. Which best captures the actual words of the pasuk? I think the first two do. So when Rashbam is the one guilty of explaining what happened so far against, although Mr. Arkelov seems to think that that was Rashbam's pshat, you still think that this can fit our bad Shulchan? Shulchan is,
I don't think Moshe could have thrown. I don't think, just
translate the words. I just want to know what bad Shulchan means. Okay. All right. No.
So,
you're a good limud for Rashbam.
Don't we believe that there is intrinsic holiness in the name of God? Wasn't the God
no?
The name of God?
If the name of God was intrinsically holy, he certainly wouldn't have it put into a cup of water for a woman to drink to determine sota, or he wouldn't allow it to ever be destroyed if it's intrinsically. This is precisely why God doesn't allow himself to be represented by the Nile. Turn it to blood. Look what happens to the God. The God of Israel, it's much more difficult to worship such a God in ancient Near East, to be sure. You can't see him. You can't experience him. You can't hold him. You can't take him in a little picture. Right? It's probably why none of you have ever dreamt about God. Some Christian theologians I know dream about God all the time because they have a picture of their God that they worship. They're worshiping a God they're looking at all the time. There's a statue of him in his house. There are pictures of him all over the house. There's a picture of him on a cross over the shoulder, right? To us, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is an idea.
But why do we...
For the ancient man, this is very complicated.
Why is it a problem to throw out a Tanakh, like to put a Tanakh in the trash or put it on the floor?
Chas v'shalom, we don't put it in the trash, we bury it. Lo tasu kein Hashem Elokeichem. The Gemara says, "Destroy Avodah Zarah, but don't destroy what's." Doesn't mean it has inherent holiness. Of course, it's holy. Tefillin is holy. Of course, it is. I'm not saying to treat tefillin like a shoelace, but the fact is, whatever went into making your shoes could have gone into making tefillin. That means that it's not inherently holy. Otherwise, how was the Aron taken by the Philistines? How was the Beis Hamikdash destroyed? Nothing physical has that. If there's anything I would suggest, and this is now getting into a philosophy class, that's the holiest thing in the universe, it would be the human body. Why? Of course, because it's Tzelem Elokim. I can't say that about the Aron or the Beis HaMikdash or Yud Kei Vav Kei written within. I can't say that about that. Right? What's interesting, I just tell you, is that when you make a mishaberach for someone, you say that may God send a refuah to his ramach evarim b'shasagidim. Like, so, as if to say that the body is like a sefer Torah. The different parts that make up the gidim and evarim of the human body is like a sefer Torah. And that's just, again, that's just, you know. Okay, question.
Just a question on Gilgul. What would those...
Can you answer that in class, if you don't mind? It's really good. It's really, there's a lot written on it, to be sure, but I'd like to get my philosophies from the Babylonian or Jerusalem Talmud. You know, not from the Zohar. It's not found in any Medrash. Right? Zohar, that you can get into a discussion of what's the Zohar source and why is it so prevalent in mysticism but not in more mainstream Jewish thought. So, okay, that's fine. It's certainly the greatest mystic of these four, but that's for sure. Okay. All right. Look, I don't know if you feel as at home with these four, but these are the four pillars that make up how the Torah was and Tanakh was understood for the first 500 years of Parshanut. Okay. Got it. There are many, many offshoots of these guys. You know, I can be real bad, I can make him a doc, I can, you know, but for these guys, I can get really, there's 200 names I could put down here. And they all appear on charts of these Ashkenazic commentaries that gleaned from them and often quoted them. I'll just give you a few of the main ones. Rav Yosef Kara. Not to be confused with
someone who lived 300 years later, Rabbi Yosef Karo, who wrote the Shulchan Aruch. This is an Ashkenazic student, chaver of Rashi. Right? Rabbi Yosef Karo, B'chor Shor, next to Chizkuni, maybe is someone you might recognize. Da'at Zakenim, right? Bali Atostus. Okay, so these are... This guy became very popular. I think that he was put into the Koros Gadolus, right? What I'd like to do with you now is to this is in your Choberet. There's a page of Mikros Gedolos that appears in your Choberet. Now, if you look at the page of Mikros Gedolos, what's appearing? Who gets in? Who didn't get in? Why did some guys get in? So the first time a Mikros Gedolos was ever printed was the year 1524. Notice that's quite a long time after printing press is available. Right? It's not the first Jewish book printed. Okay, Jewish books had been printed for 25, 30 years, but you know, to keep Jews away from printing is like to keep Jews away from the internet now. And I assure you, printing made a greater splash of communication in 1453 than the internet did whenever Al Gore invented it. All right, so you're too young to even know what that means. So in the presidential debates, he said that he introduced the internet, which probably cost him the presidency. He was so mocked for so long. I mean, he lost his own state. If he carried his state, he would have won. Right? So in 1524, a bunch of Christians called together a few Jews to help them put out a book that was sure to be grabbed by every Jew. Right? Jews constituted a very small percentage of the population of Europe due to forced conversions and 1524, many years, the Inquisitions, the Jews were forced to the New World, right? But they did constitute a majority of the readers of Europe. We all read. Every Jew reads, because you have to read, you have to daven in the Siddur, you have to read Chumash, right? But not all Christians read. In fact, mostly only clergy read. Okay. All right, so there were more Jews than clergy. Okay, anyway, so in 1524, this Mikros Gedolos, which was a huge, huge sefer, like this, right? So it's really a misnomer to refer to this as a Mikros Gedolos. These ones called Mikros Gedolos, the size of the book, right? But, all right, anything that had a series of commentaries in it became known as Mikros Gedolos, all right? So I didn't even use this as the example of the Mikros Gedolos in your Choberet. I used the 1905 version of Mikros Gedolos. You probably recognize different ones from different places. Just to make sure. I'll just tell you how it was constructed. Okay. Obviously, we have to have the text. Next to the text, you're going to have onkelos. Okay. Right under the text, you always had every Mikros Gedolos ever printed. They put Ramban said. He is the Bechor of commentary. You put Rashi right here. Right under the text. Open up any Mikros Gedolos, he's always right under the text. Rashi. Now, in some Mikros Gedolos, like the one that I'm working with you, which is a 1905 edition, from 1524 to today, there have been many editions of the Mikros Gedolos. Okay, the first one, if you remember the date, printed under Jewish auspices, was 200 years later, 1724 in Amsterdam. Okay, using largely the typeset of this. Right, so until we have something called a scientific edition of a particular commentary, I'm relying on what this Christian group put together in 1524. And you can imagine their mistakes. Right? Okay, I call it a Christian group. They had Jews involved. The head of this group certainly seems to have Jewish background. Was a Christian named Daniel Bamberg. A name like that, he has to be probably his grandfather was forced to convert the name. Daniel Bamberg. Okay, so is Rashi. In the text we'll be discussing 1905, there's Sifsei Chachamim right opposite Rashi. You've heard of this, right? Sifsei Chachamim was, his name was Shabsai, Rav Shabsai, and he is an anthology of Perushei Rashi. Very rarely is he saying something original in his explanation of Rashi. Why they chose him, Sifsei Chachamim, over, really, by the time in 1905, there were already 200 Perushei Rashi. Okay? He's an anthology, meaning if you would just take, let's say, what's considered the best of all the Perushei Rashi, the Mizrahi, Eliyahu Mizrahi. First of all, that's too long, right? The Sifsei Chachamim just anthologizes and shortens the commentaries people give in Rashi. So he was good. Remember, space is of a premium. In 1524, Rabban did not make the first cut because it's too long. Right? He's longer than everybody else. He's twice as long as Rashi. Abravanel never made a cut. He's really long. He's three times as long as Rashi. Very verbose, right? 1524 was a perfect time to put Abravanel in the Mikros Gedolos. He had just died. He was quite famous, and his Perush is very well organized. His commentary, I should say, you follow, you'll see. He introduces every section he's going to comment on. I'm about to comment on the Akedas Yitzchak, and here are 47 questions I have on the Akedas Yitzchak. And then he goes about answering them. The problem is he doesn't answer them in order. And the original printer didn't underline when he's answering them. Right? Well, now people are working on the Bravanel to do this. He says, wow, that question 33 is a great question. But then you have to read 20 pages to figure out where he's answering question 33. Because it's not after question 32. Question 32 could be after question 3 in the answer. Why do it then? So it's very disorganized in the answers. The questions, sometimes I just read the questions and I say, forget, I'm not reading his answers. I'm going to, you know. It's a good question. Okay, anyway. So large perushim don't make the first cut because space is a premium. Right, you with me? Okay, so Rashi, Sifsei Chachamim. Right? Ibn Ezra made the first cut. Okay. But when the Christians in this group found Ibn Ezra's Perush, they found that he had two Perushim to the Torah. I think I told you this once before. Ibn Ezra wrote two commentaries to the Torah. But, so that means that five of commentary one and five of commentary two, right? There should be 10 different books of Ibn Ezra. With me? They only found 6, and to this day we only have 6. Luckily, one of them we have all 5 of. It's not like 3 to this one and 3 to that one. We have all 5, and we only have 1 to the other book, Shmos. And there's a clear, clear difference between the one on Shmos and the other 5. The first very obvious difference, which is what gives the one on Shmos its name, is Perush HaAroch. It's much, much longer. So that if you look on any book in Bereishis, Ibn Ezra is usually a small little box on the page. Very concise. But in Shmos, he gobbles up the whole page. That's just, it's Ibn Ezra. No text even. He's eating up the whole page. He does this all over the place in Shmos.
If there are two of them, why did they put the long one?
So the Christians put the long one for Shmos and the short one for the other 4 in the same Mikros Gedolos. No notes, no explanations. You think it's the same Perush, it's really not. It's written, first of all, they're written about 40 years apart.
What did you do with the short one?
We have it. So now, more modern Mikraot Gedolos are usually printed in Shmos with both. Because Ibn Ezra says things in Bereishis quite often where he says, I'll explain this on this pasuk in Shmos, and you don't find it. Right? He says about the sneh. What does the word sneh mean in Shmos? And he says, my proof text is in Devarim, and on the pasuk in Devarim, he disagrees. He mentions that parish, and he says, no, that's incorrect. He changed his mind 40 years later. Right? The two Perushim, he had certain experiences in the middle. He only mentions Rashbam in the long Shmos, but never in the other, in the short Perush. Right? In the short Perush, whenever he quotes a Karaite, he makes fun of their name, he disparages them, he says they're kofrim. In the long Shmos, he mentions Karaites with like respect. What happens to him in between? Why aren't you poking fun of them? Right? He met some Karaites that he thought were worthy to comment, to quote. Right? Okay, I'm just saying. So they decided, and it, look, was it a good decision? The parish of Shmos is definitely superior, the long one. Right? Because it was written later in life. So you tend to write better things later in life, yes. With your experiences. So it would be great if you could find the other four long perushim. That's a great find waiting to happen. I bet it's in the Vatican someplace. Right? Together with a lot of maybe an original Rashi also or two. Right? So Ibn Ezra makes the cut. Right? Now I'm doing 1905. Ramban, of course, is in the latest right? Rashbam is also in. Da'as Sekenim is in. That's an Ashkenazic commentary. That is, I must tell you, Da'as Sekenim is a cross between Rashbam and Rashi. Very pshat oriented, but is ready to go off and drash even more than Rashi sometimes. They just wanted to, you know, want to give you a combination. Why did 1905 they included the Da'as Sekenim in this document? It's just so much space, right? Okay. Another big new addition is Sforno. Have you heard Sforno? The correct pronunciation is Sforno. Sforno should be Sforno. Okay, it's the name of a city in Italy. His commentary is so concise and so filled. It is so... He just small little insights about family in Vayeshev, about sibling rivalry and he's a doctor. He incorporates medical knowledge into short little perushim. He incorporates psychological points into his perush. Really an amazing perush. And it's so short. You know, read one line in Sforno and it can get you thinking for and debating for an hour.
Oh, I'm sorry. Right. Something wrong with the desk.
I didn't call that in. Now, the Mikraot Gedolos, after the first one, right, there's very little pshat activity going on. Two very midrashic and homiletic commentaries were added. Or HaChaim, he's very popular now in Hasidic and Sephardic circles. Chaim Ben Attar, have you heard him? No? And the Kli Yakar. Kli Yakar is beautiful, beautiful homiletic commentaries. And if you're speaking to the Sheva Bracha tonight and you want to see a good perush to give on the parasha or something, just go look at Kli Yakar. Just amazing, amazing insights and homiletic. Every statement of his is some kind of deep message of the human condition. Right? That's why he got so popular to be put into the Mikraot Gedolos. Right? Now, remember when we talked about Targumim, this 1905 edition also included Targum Yonasan and Yerushalmi to the Torah, with even a Perush to Yonasan. Wow. I think this is a strange. Targum Yonasan to the Torah. Remember we learned about 2 months ago, Unkelos was Babylonian Aramaic, Yonasan is Yerushalmi Aramaic. Unkelos states strict to the Pshat, Yonasan gave drash, an explanation of the psukim. Onkelos says they sold Yosef for 20 pieces of silver. That's Onkelos. Yonason says they sold him for a pair of shoes. How do you know they sold him for a pair of shoes? Because there's a tradition they sold him. So he includes traditions and other midrashim. Right? Okay. Right. Finally, there's one little tiny little thing that you feel you see in Rosh Tevos. This stands for Toldos Aharon. The original Mikros Gedolos was printed with this Perush that gives you, I'm sorry, the 1905 Mikros Gedolos was printed with this that tells you where to find this Pasuk in a Gemara. Where will you find this Pasuk in a Gemara? Okay? On Thursday, what we are going to do is to discuss what happened to this page of Mikros Gedolos in more recent times. Now look in your Choveret, you'll see in the middle of your Choveret there's a page that has the picture of the Mikros Gedolos from, it's on page 72, is the new picture. Page 73 and 74 is the old picture. Okay? The only thing I skipped in here is the Bala Tur, the author of the Shulchan Aruch. 72, 73, and 74. There will be a question on your quiz from these three pages. All right? Look at it. 72, 73, 74. Review what we did. Remember what we just did today on this? The next class will begin by showing how did the Mikros Gedolos change in the most recent one. And by the way, there's another one. The Das Mikra just printed a Mikros Gedolos about 25 years ago. There's a new one now that Art Scrolls has printed. Usually it takes 100 years to wait for a new Mikros Gedolos to come out. Art Scrolls did it within 20 years. It's amazing. Hey guys.